Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we begin with the grim story of this mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, outside of San Antonio yesterday afternoon, in which 19 children in grades 2 through 4 were murdered, as well as were two teachers, by a former student at that school. Joe Biden, getting back from his Asian trip, addressed the nation on the aftermath of this massacre, saying the following.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done?
312-642-5600, Turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, Turnkey.pro text line. In Buffalo a week ago, it was about race. In Uvalde yesterday, it's going to be about guns. That's what the left does. Whenever there are dead bodies, you will find them on the scene to promote new and exciting infringements on individual liberty. And that's what the big guy was proposing yesterday, yet again, with a chorus of leftists in tow.
Okay. I'm going to say something, and you're going to just pounce on me, and people can call in, and I really don't care. Why do we need assault rifles? Did you see the shooting inside that grocery store? It was an AK-47, or was it AK-15, but it was modified, yes. Why do you need that kind of gun power? Why? I don't understand why that isn't just reserved for, you know, for wartime. I mean, it was rapid fire shots. The one in, and we don't know, he had a handgun, we know that, and then a long arm and probably an assault rifle that was used in this case too. But I don't understand. I'm a gun owner, a responsible one, and I'm okay with background checks. I get it.
What kind of gun?
I have a 38 special and a 9mm and then a double barrel shotgun that we've had for a long time. And
why probably shouldn't. Why do you need a double barrel shotgun?
That was actually, it was not. That's my husband's. That's not mine. I should say that right now, because I've never fired that weapon.
Why do you need two guns?
One for different individuals in the house, and one for that. Well, I don't want to tell everything, Dan, because I'm not even should even say that I own weapons, because now I'm a target, so people can come into my house and try and get my guns.
Well,
they're locked in a safe.
It, so
okay. Oh. Well, I'm just, it's help me why we need this kind of weaponry.
We need.
Or people want. What desire, long for.
I have an MP sport rifle.
Okay. And do you go hunting with that? Do you go to the range with it?
Yeah, I go to the range.
Okay. And I don't even, I have to look that up. What is it, an MP?
It's an MP sport. It's a rifle, like an AR.
All right.
So if you take my MP sport rifle away, we're going to be safer? No more school shootings? Is that the proposition?
No.
Well, then what's the proposition?
And I don't know, if more background checks, that's not going to work. Keeping guns out of the mentally ill would be a start.
What evidence do we have that this individual is mentally ill, other than the atrocity that he committed?
Have you seen his Instagram pictures? There's something going on here.
Well, yeah, there's right. What's the clinical diagnosis?
I don't know.
Do we have one? Right.
I don't know if they know. I don't know if he knows. He was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Shot his grandmother, who is not dead, by the way. She's in critical condition. And then police chased him, and he smashed his truck right in front of the elementary school. And police were chasing after him, and he ran into the school.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully, if there was a Border Patrol agent who was working close by, he interceded. He is the individual who shot and killed the shooter.
He entered the school. And
there's all sorts of things that we don't know about the shooter less than 24 hours after this happened. There's reports of things. There's Instagram pictures that are alleged that show him with guns. There are suggestions made by people who knew him, who he apparently worked at Wendy's with, that suggest he was aggressive, challenging people to boxing matches in local parks and so forth. There are other accounts that say he was bullied at school and made fun of for his clothes and the fact they wore eyeliner. You think we have a complete picture of this guy? Less than 24 hours later? I don't. You want to make a snap judgment on what happened and why it happened? I don't. Do we even know, exactly what happened in Buffalo more than a week ago, 10 days ago?
No.
I mean, we have this, what was called a manifesto. It was just sort of the ravings of the sort of nonsensical ravings of the individual who was responsible for those murders at that supermarket in Buffalo. Think you got a handle on it? Think we know which law we're going to pass and it's going to never have, we're never going to have another Uvalde or Sandy Hook or Buffalo Supermarket or Parkland or San Bernardino and so on and so forth? There's one thing that they all have in common, all these mass shootings, is there? Other than the fact they involve guns. So if we eliminate the instrumentality, we eliminate the threat. Can we eliminate the instrumentality?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Joe Biden, of course, thinks he has the answer. He gave us the talking points last night that he's been repeating for three decades, all of which are untrue or unsupported by any evidence.
I am sick and tired of it. We have to act. And don't tell me we can't have an impact on this carnage. I spent my career as a senator and a vice president working to pass common sense gun laws. We can and won't prevent every tragedy, but we know they work and have positive impact. When we passed the assault weapons ban, mass shootings went down. When the law expired, mass shootings tripled. The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong. What in God's name do you need an assault weapon for except to kill someone? Deer aren't running through the forest with Kevlar vests on, for God's sake. It's just sick. And the gun manufacturers have spent two decades aggressively marketing assault weapons, which make them the most and largest profit. For God's sake, we have to have the courage to stand up to the industry.
Yeah, we also have to have the courage and the information to stand up to the ignorant and the demagogues. Joe Biden is a checkbox in both of those categories. James Allen Fox is a Northeastern University professor, collected data starting in 1982 on mass shootings. Assault weapons accounted for 24% of public mass shootings. Semi-automatic handguns, 48%, far more prevalent in random massacres than weapons that would be typically classified as assault weapons. From 76 to 94, there were about 18 mass shootings that occurred each year. During the assault weapon ban, 95 to 2004, there were about 19 such incidents. So for the preceding 18 years, there were 18 a year. During the 10 years, roughly, of the assault weapon ban, 19 per year. After the ban in through 2011, went up to nearly 21 a year. It has those that data has nothing. That data in no way supports the claim that Joe Biden made about the assault weapon ban, which we know was ineffectual. And the there were other studies that provide, you know, no National Institute for Justice specifically, within the Department of Justice specifically, there's nothing significant that they can point to that suggests that it did anything, the assault, quote unquote, ban, to reduce the number of mass shooting incidents or the number of individuals killed with so-called assault weapon bans. Remember, the assault weapon ban was arbitrary and prospective. Of course, it was prospective. So you've got tens of millions of these sport rifles in circulation, and you have a ban, and then what? And again, if we're going in rank order priority as it pertains to mass shootings, we find that semi-automatic handguns are used more often than sport rifles or so-called assault weapons. So what do you want to do? There are 300 million guns in circulation in America.
Right.
So what?
We can't go door to door and confiscate 300 million weapons.
Or
should we want to?
Well,
I'm saying that's what the left wants to, and you know.
So then, what do we got? Oh, pass this legislation that's kicking around in D.C. to extend the duration, the time to do the background check from 3 days to 10 days. First of all, it becomes a impingement upon your individual Second Amendment rights. Secondly, is there some sort of evidentiary basis to suggest that would have a significant impact on reducing violent crime? I'd like to see it. I haven't.
That's what Steve Kerr was saying yesterday. We have to change the background check timing. Really?
Carl in Southern Indiana.
I'd like to take Amy's question of why we have weapons in America to protect ourselves from a tyrannical government. And you said something about the 80s with the gun ban. Also in the early 80s, Tip O'Neill managed to talk to President Reagan into getting rid of county farms where the crazies all stayed at. Yeah, correlation. You know, let's go back to the county farms. It gives those people purpose, and it would also help with the homeless problem.
Thanks for the call, Carl.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the horrific murder of 19 grade schoolers and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, yesterday. And what should be done about it, if anything can be done about it. Joe Biden says, sure, something can be done about it. The big guy says, you got to take on the gun lobby. You got to ban assault weapons. The left is saying some other things you need to do specific to this community in Texas. Juliet Kayyem, who is a flack for CNN and The Atlantic, we talked a little bit about a piece she wrote for The Atlantic, Steve Jobs' widow's outlet there. Last week about Buffalo, where she blamed right-wing media for Buffalo. Remember,
yeah,
Buffalo
was
about race,
Tucker
great
Carlson's
replacement theory. It's conservative media is to blame for Buffalo. So it was race there. It's guns here. But as I said, wherever there are dead bodies, you will find leftists showing up to leverage tragedy to restrict individual liberty with the false promise that they alone can protect you from all the evil in the world. Here's Juliet Kayyem suggesting what must be done immediately in Uvalde.
From an investigation standpoint, I'm going to do what the facts tell me now. So I've got demographics, first of all, an 80% Hispanic school district. So the most important thing for the federal government to do right now is to say there will be no immigration enforcement during this period in that area. It has a large immigration population. You want parents with their kids. You don't want people hiding right now. And we need to make that clear ASAP because of the political issues in Texas.
So the first order of business is suspend ICE and ICE's presence in that larger San Antonio region.
This is a town. It's a small farming community, 15,000 people. It's about an hour from the border. So it's not. It's 80 miles away from San Antonio. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere because, you know, but ICE had nothing to do with this. So she's out of her mind.
She's not saying they had anything to do with it. In fact, as we know, a Border Patrol agent stopped
the mass murder
that was occurring.
But these are second, third, and fourth graders. And she says that.
This is the important issue. You have to suspend any sort of immigration law enforcement operations in that community. You mentioned Steve Kerr before the break, before game four yesterday, where his Warriors lost to the Mavs, still up 3-1. Steve Kerr didn't want to talk about basketball.
No, because he didn't, you know, because you said, well, we're going to do another stupid moment of silence before the game for the victims. How many times have we done that?
Yeah, instead.
And that's true. I mean, that's going to change things? No, it's not going to change things.
And it neither is a stupid left-wing rant from Steve Kerr, who knows nothing about anything in the adult world except professional basketball, as far as I can tell.
Since we left Shoot Around, 14 children were killed 400 miles from here, and a teacher. And in the last 10 days, we've had elderly black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something? I'm tired. I'm so tired of getting up here and offering condolences to the devastated families that are out there. I'm so tired of the, excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm tired of the moments of silence. Enough. There's 50 senators right now who refuse to vote on H.R. 8, which is a background check rule that the House passed a couple of years ago. It's been sitting there for 2 years. And there's a reason they won't vote on it, to hold on to power. So I ask you, Mitch McConnell, I ask all of you senators who refuse to do anything about the violence and school shootings and supermarket shootings, I ask you, are you going to put your own desire for power ahead of the lives of our children and our elderly and our churchgoers? Because that's what it looks like. It's what we do every week. So I'm fed up. I've had enough. We're going to play the game tonight. But I want every person here, every person listening to this, to think about your own child or grandchild or mother or father or sister or brother. How would you feel if this happened to you today? We can't get numb to this. We can't sit here and just read about it and go, well, let's have a moment of silence. Yeah, go Dubs, you know. Come on, Mavs, let's go. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go play a basketball game. And 50 senators in Washington are going to hold us hostage. Do you realize that 90% of Americans, regardless of political party, want background check, universal background check? 90% of us, we are being held hostage by 50 senators in Washington who refuse to even put it to a vote, despite what we, the American people, want. They won't vote on it because they want to hold on to their own power. It's pathetic. I've had enough.
Do we do the slow clap here? Is that the slow clap? Is that what is appropriate here after his little tantrum?
Universal background checks. So we have background checks. We talked about we purchase weapons. You had to have a 3-day waiting period, and in some states it's longer. What does he want them to vote? Is that going to change?
Well, first of all,
we have rules on the book, right? Am I getting this right, Dan?
Yeah.
Okay.
The HR8, which is sponsored by a Dem socialist from Texas, purports to quote unquote close the gun show loophole, which there isn't one. But it, just even setting that aside for a moment, what we know from what happened in Uvalde at this point is that the shooter purchased his guns legally from a federally licensed firearm dealer after his 18th birthday. So there was a background check, and he was able to purchase the guns. So what would HR 8 have done to change what happened in Uvalde yesterday? Oh, I'm sorry. Am I interrupting Steve Kerr's tantrum? And the left tantrum generally?
Steve Kerr's father was fatally shot and died. Steve Kerr's friend, Brian Williams, was murdered. So, yes, he used his platform, because you use your platform, I use my platform. He used his platform to push home something that it's not going to change anything. I mean, he should know that there's background checks already in place.
Why would he know that? He doesn't know what his position is on concentration camps in China, per China's support of the NBA. He had to consult with his brother-in-law, who's some sort of Chinese history scholar, allegedly, before he could make a determination on whether concentration camps are a bad thing or not, because, of course, he's in the pocket of the Chi-Coms, as is the NBA. But he's a man of principle. So passionate. He's using his platform. Yeah, I know he's using his platform. And I know, I understand he's an NBA basketball coach and one that's won championships, so he has a big platform. So what? The question isn't that he's using it. The question is, how is he using it? The question is, does he have any idea what he's talking about? The
question is spreading misinformation.
Yeah. And he's a child.
Oh, I love Steve Kerr. Oh,
I'm glad you do. So you can love him till your dying breath.
He's a good man.
He's a ignoramus. And that performance yesterday is counterproductive. Not only is it unproductive, it's counterproductive. That carrying on like that.
Well, Senator Ted Cruz, one that he called out, you know, he's one of the 50 senators, responded.
That doesn't work. It's not effective. It doesn't prevent crime. We know what does prevent crime, which is going after felons and fugitives and those with serious mental illness, arresting them, prosecuting them when they try to illegally buy firearms.
Yeah, this is pretty straightforward stuff.
But the mental illness aspect, everybody's so touchy to talk about it. And it's just,
nobody's touchy to talk about it. It's just more complicated than just invoking mental illness. We need to do something about mental illness. Okay, what? What specifically do you have in mind?
Well, how can we stop the mentally ill from purchasing weapons? How? You mentioned earlier he worked at the Wendy's and people said he was aggressive and tried to get in fights at parks. And
so what? Does that make
it's a
you
small town? Everybody knows everything about everyone.
Does that make you mentally ill? There's a lot of young men who are aggressive. There are a lot of young men who pick fights. Does it make you mentally ill? Does that mean they're a mass shooter? I mean, this is the problem: is we get tunnel vision in these cases, and we say, well, these are the markers. The problem is that there are millions of other people that have those same markers that never commit a crime. Much less a violent crime. And if people actually want to listen to people that know what they're talking about, like Theodore Dalrymple, who we've had on this show many times, who is a prison psychiatrist for his professional career, who is actually an expert in mental illness and has written much on the topic. People are actually interested in knowing who people like that are and understanding their perspectives from a life's work of scholarship as well as being a practitioner, then maybe we would get somewhere. But instead, we have to indulge Steve Kerr. Morons. Children throwing tantrums and thinking they're doing something important. Politicians running around invoking guns or invoking mental illness. These are just buzzwords that they use to pretend like, well, or to, because they don't know, because they haven't done the homework. They haven't thought this through. So, do something in mental illness. do something on guns. Do something over here. Just do something so we can say we did something. Does the something have to be effective? No. No. Could it be a unnecessary restriction on people's individual liberty? Sure, as long as we do something so I can score the political points for having done something. And that's the Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, parading around the Senate floor like Steve Kerr yesterday. The idea that there is some simple, linear solution to these horrors that have occurred and continue to occur in this country, it's a lie. So you can content yourself with the beautiful lies that politicians and the culturally and policy illiterati like Steve Kerr promote, or you can really think through this and ask the questions, the follow-up questions to those that just say, do something, pass H.R. 8. Yeah, that's a panacea, right, Steve? Funding for mental illness. Funding where, how, for what purpose, to what end? How is it measured?
Well, what about, I mean, social media? He texted this chick on Instagram saying, you know, why don't you repost my gun pictures? And she said, why are you tagging me? He said, I just wanted to tag you. And he said, be grateful I tagged you. And she said, why? And he responded, I got a little secret I want to tell you, with a smiley face emoji. And then he said, I'm out. And then,
and so what is, I mean, what is your interpretation of that?
That pretending it's an 18-year-old kid trying to flirt with somebody when his guns. I don't know.
Right.
I think kids that take pictures with weapons that are 18-year-olds, that are people in small towns, they know it's going to come out today. I'm sure. Yes, this is conjecture on my part, but from all that we're hearing, that he had some mental health issues. So why? If you see that on social media, you know, it keeps telling people, if you see something, say something. Here's another instance. If you see something, say something.
What are you going to say? What should have been done? Based on what we know and what you're, even if you include your conjecture with this, the things we don't know.
Contacting the FBI, making sure that this person, when they try and buy a weapon, cannot get a weapon. Mm-hmm. But then you have to, you know, what makes somebody mentally ill? What's, you know, what's the difference between being, you know, bipolar, crazy, and mentally ill? I don't know. I don't know the answer. But if they're putting this stuff on social media, it's like a cry for help or attention.
Right. If we're going to have the FBI go after every teenager that is issuing a cry for attention on social media, then we're going to have to expand the bureau quite a bit.
Yeah.
Greg Schomburg.
Hi, Dan and Amy. First of all, part of my heart goes out to you, Amy, and my head and my heart goes out to you, Dan. The root cause is because our society has opened up evil and Satan to the minds of vulnerable and people that would normally have a community around them that would shield it. When you gave up on abortion and opened Satan's door to destroy life, and then followed with gays, and then followed with marriage, and then followed with trans, and whatever else is coming, you have minds out there that Satan has an open door to. And the only answer that I can come up with as to the instrumentality, Dan is dead right with the fact that it's always going to be something that, you know, is going to be coming in with the Obamaites to restrict our liberties. So, Amy, the only thing that I can say that we would have to do is we have to build a better sense of community that works in conjunction with the legal system and with the police departments, that when you do see something like the Instagram post or something, there's a group of people that know that they can surround that person and bring attention to them and get them help. It's got to get that person to the people that help to get Satan out of their mind. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Greg. Dave, Mount Prospect.
Hey, I grew up down there in Uvalde, mm-hmm. and actually went to that school. I might be able to point out that watching Biden make his speech last night was kind of laughable.
Why?
On account of... Hi, sorry.
No, I said why. Why was it laughable?
Well, because growing up down there, I mean, right now, if you really want to look at it, that border is porous. You could ban all the guns you want on this side of the border, and people will still find a way to smuggle their weapons into places like Uvalde or down in Carrizo where my mom and my brother live. Even if you did make the guns illegal, people down there have been using them since forever. And they need them now because my mom can't even go out into her backyard without groups of people running across it, trying to dodge the cops or trying to dodge the border patrol. And nobody down there is unarmed anymore. Somebody's always carrying something. It's unfortunate that, you know, this kid did what he did. It's sad, but, you know, every once in a while, somebody's going to go off the rails. That's how the law of averages seems to work. Bad things will happen. But just because one person did a bad thing doesn't mean that everyone else has to pay the price. And on top of that, in a place like Uvalde, which is a border community, disarming the population for the sake of placating your political base does no good for the people that live on the border, especially when we have an idiot that refuses to enforce security at the border. If the police are unable to do it, then it's going to fall on the people to have to defend themselves. And, you know, as I had friends and family that still live in Uvalde, and I don't want to call and find out who lost family because it would hurt right now. It's raw. But I would not want to see them disarmed because, you know, something worse could happen the day after tomorrow. It's a tough call when something like this happens, but at the end of the day, people need to be able to defend themselves. It's easy when you live 5 minutes away from a police station.
Yeah, Dave,
it's Sorry.
We're up against the clock, but I do appreciate your perspective. Thanks for giving us a call. Appreciate that.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about, of course, the horror that happened in Uvalde yesterday at the elementary school there, the Robb Elementary School, with 19 children murdered, two teachers.
Yes, second, third, and fourth graders, so 7-, 8-, 9-year-olds, 2-, 10-year-olds. And parents late last night had to submit DNA testing because the kids were so badly, horrifically shot that they couldn't identify them. So that's why parents were around crying, saying, "Have you seen my child?" Because they were one of the victim's parents, but didn't know it at the time.
I'll take a couple calls. I want to get to last night's gubernatorial debates, plural, even though there's only six candidates. And then we'll revisit this. But a couple calls quickly on it, a couple more. Betsy Northside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I love you both. You do such a great service for the city. You know, first of all, what I want to say is it is so obvious, even to, pardon me to use this word, an idiot, what is causing all this violence. It's a cultural problem. We know exactly who has the guns, how they got them, and why they commit all these horrific murders. Okay? It doesn't mean we need to give up our Second Amendment right. That would be the worst thing.
No.
Because then that means that the government has more control than they already have. And just if I may add, because I heard a previous caller, your callers are great, and I will say this, you have a diverse group, because I'm one of them. I happen to be gay, I happen to be pro-choice, but I want people to know that does not mean that I don't agree with you on so many issues, And if we could unite on even some of these issues, the Republicans will win again.
All right. Thank you, Betsy. Appreciate the call. David Winnetka.
Yeah, hey, good morning. First and foremost, you correct me up when you called Kerr an ignoramus, but because he is. A couple of things. The A in the AR, it stands for Armalite. It's not assault. And that word assault right. is just, you know, it impedes doom and gloom and everything else. People really should start calling it, you know, it is what it is. Actually, that firearm should be called the Protector. Second thing I want to say, yes, it is definitely mental health. That so instead of a disinformation board, why doesn't the government start, you know, a mental health watch when you see people coming along down the pipe that may be questionable? That's all I got. Next question.
Well, thanks, David.
The Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, he was on the scene and said, yeah, we don't need to de-arm people. We need to arm people.
Well, look, you know, people that are shooting people, that are killing kids, they're not going to follow. They're not following murder laws. They're not going to follow gun laws. So this idea that somehow if you ban guns from law-abiding citizens, somehow these people that kill people, they're going to follow the gun law, but they won't follow the murder law. This is somewhat ridiculous, but it seems to be the argument that they make. And they always forget that these are not law-abiding citizens. They're the ones that kill people. So it makes no sense to me. I'd much rather have law-abiding citizens armed and trained so that they can respond when something like this happens, because it's not going to be the last time.
Okay.
Do you agree with them?
Do I agree with them? I mean, it's... What are you talking about? That's a positively trite statement. Of course I agree with them. Law-abiding citizens should have the right to protect themselves, and you don't punish the law-abiding for the acts of the non-law-abiding. That's essentially what he said. Wow, that's revolutionary. So you said Steve Kerr is not an ignoramus. You don't think so? Elaborate.
I have known him for decades. My mom has known him. She was his insurance agent in Tucson. I've broken bread with. I mean, I've been to his house. He's a nice man. Do I agree with him politically? No, but I don't think he's an ignoramus.
So, what his tantrum that he had yesterday? Which part of that was accurate?
There are background checks already on the books.
So it was inaccurate or was accurate?
It was inaccurate.
Oh, okay.
HR 8 is
so
not going to say. I'm just
topic.
Saying, but he's not.
So
he's ignorant on the topic, but I don't feel Thank like you. He is a bad man.
I didn't say bad. I said ignorant.
Ignorant on
bad.
The topic.
Ignorant is ignorant.
Okay.
Jordan in Forest Park.
Yeah, I'd like to know how many of the teachers at that school had Texas concealed carry licenses that, because of the, according to the school board's website, they're not allowed to carry in the school, but they probably had them in their cars. And so I think there's a responsibility of the school districts. You know, we've had several of these shootings. And to me, school boards must have had some discussion about should we arm teachers, should we not? And it seems to me there ought to be two layers of protection on this whole thing. One, you've got to have some security locks like a lot of schools do. But you've got to have a backup plan. And to me, you've got to have at least a couple of the teachers carrying. And let's spend some money and have them go through some advanced training. You know, there's plenty of training schools all over the country that they could be sent to at least try to have a plan in place in case something happens. But
yeah, why wasn't the door locked? So simple. In CPS, you have to press the button and you stand there and they look at you. Like, it's so maddening that he was just able to run into that school.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. You know, 42 states do like evacuation or active shooter drills in schools. Yeah. We have talked ad nauseum, frankly, over the years about hardening targets. Obviously, that's a school district by school district decision.
It's a small town.
With respect to armed security, with respect to arming teachers, you're not going to impose. Teachers carry a weapon. It would have to be something that some teachers volunteer to do, and that is going to differ from school to school and so forth. So, yes, it's all part of the conversation, sure, to make these as unattractive targets for somebody intent on committing an act of evil as possible.
And I love what Max Solomon
said. But we also know very little about everything that transpired yesterday. And it's more often the case than not that there is initial reporting that has to be corrected when you have a chaotic situation like you had yesterday. So I'd suggest that we let this develop a little bit more and make sure we understand what we don't understand before we start making pronouncements about what Uvalde should do and what every school should do because of what happened at Uvalde and so forth.
Well, what we do know is he shot his grandmother, who is still alive, and police responded to that scene, and then he led them on a chase, crashed his car, his black truck in front of the middle school or the elementary school, then got out, and he was wearing, you know, combat gear and ran into the school.
Mike in Union.
Morning. Last week, I listened to an interview with people on the street about Chicago violence. The public, not our, the people listening to this radio station, but most people think that street violence in Chicago is a mental health issue. Well, we know it's not. Yesterday was purely evil. That's mental illness. The argument on the left is total opposite. What we saw yesterday was evil and possibly mental illness. Street violence in Chicago, pure violence, not mental illness. We need to win this argument in a public square, just like you're doing now, Dan. Appreciate you. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Although, you know, some of the atrocities that are committed under the heading street violence in Chicago and elsewhere, there are some perpetrators that, perhaps require a more thorough examination, whether they're gang affiliated or not. Some of these horrific acts that are committed, the indiscriminate killing of people, mm-hmm. opening fire on a crowded street corner at State and Chicago,
yeah.
There maybe is something additional going on there. We shouldn't just relegate it to so-called street violence because it happens on the street, or it happens that it started with an argument or somebody's gang affiliated. I think that's more complicated than we give it credit for, too. And by the way, you know, when it's concentrated, like 19 grammar school kids being murdered, you know, of course, we're stunned and horrified.
Poor babies.
We'll never be desensitized to that sort of carnage. But when it happens over the course of 6 months, a year, you know, every other week or two in Chicago, we are desensitized, aren't we? We don't bring the same attention, focused dialogue, moral outrage to what happens over an extended period of time, even when the body count turns out to be the same.
I mean, God, my God, last year we had a one-month-old in Chicago shot in the head during a mass shooting. A one-month-old. And thank God that child survived.
Tom Oswego.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm a 61-year-old father of three, and what disappoints me when these situations happen, and they will happen again, is that we don't have leadership. I don't hear people talking about the breakdown of the family unit and also taking faith out of the community. I'll tell you what, I have, again, three children. During the course of their lives so far, they've had a lot of issues happen in their life. What's kept us grounded is family. We've always relied on family. And without a good, strong moral foundation in these children's lives, this stuff is going to happen. And it disappoints me, again, that our leaders, all they talk about is gun violence. Well, again, in my opinion, there's no such thing as gun violence. There's people violence. Dan and Amy, I have plenty of guns in my home, and not one time has one of my guns jumped up and shot somebody.
Yeah.
So this is really, we're focusing on the wrong thing. Now, guns, okay. You don't want guns in the hands of unstable people. So the background check, if it has to be extended a little bit, that doesn't bother me.
That
doesn't bother me. But what does bother me is when these things happen, you don't hear one of these leaders, either in the black community, Asian community,
You know, any of these communities talk about the breakdown of the family unit. And I'm telling you, if we don't get address that, that's going to be the demise of our society. We glorify single parent families nowadays on television shows. You know, the kids think they can just raise a child and everything's fine. There's so much more to this. And I just wish our quote unquote leaders, so-called, would address the root of the problem. But that's hard because yeah. You have to really dig down, and they don't know how to do that, or they won't do it. They just look for that simple thing, that soundbite on television that everyone's going to jump on. We got to pray for these kids, and just God bless you guys for bringing attention to some of these issues.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'll be interested to hear more about the shooter's family situation.
Yeah,
since it was a grandmother who was shot. We've talked about the family situations in previous mass shootings of this order, and they're almost always quite complicated and less than ideal. Not that it excuses it, and not that that necessarily is determinative of anything, because, of course, there are tens of millions of more young people in less than ideal family situations who never commit a crime, much less a violent crime. So, again, the idea that we sort of zero in to the God particle here, if you will, or the Satan particle, more apt in this case, of what makes somebody do something like was done yesterday. Yeah, you can believe these politicians telling you beautiful lies if you want, but I don't know. And neither do they. And that false promise, they alone can keep you safe. Steve in Lake County.
Hey, Danny, Amy. I just really wanted to say that there's really three types of people in this world. There's wolves, there's sheep, and there's sheepdogs.
Yeah, I saw American
and
Sniper.
And I really think that schools could really use the help of volunteer parents, volunteer ex-law enforcement, volunteer ex-military to come in their schools and be armed and maybe make a difference. I also think it would put behavior in schools in check when they know, hey, Johnny's dad is, you know, roaming the halls or whatever the case may be.
I agree with that.
It could be a solution.
They do that in some schools.
Well, there's actually the story that we talked about here maybe a year ago, a bunch of dads at a school in Louisiana. They got together because there was fighting going on. These are black men, black fathers, got together and as a group said, our kids aren't going to be fighting in school anymore. And they're there. You know, they do rotations or, you know, schedule when everybody can be scheduled. But, I mean, these guys are not messing around. And now the messing around has stopped at that high school. It was a really good story to your point. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. More parental involvement and specifically dads.
And they let the kids know, too, like you're loved. Hey, and they had a problem, they'd come and talk to them and hug it out. And just because some of the kids that don't have two parents that need fathers, there they are.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Yeah, a lot of it's about people being unable to control their emotions. This is what I talked about before. Margaret Thatcher said that a lot of the society problems that we have are by people not being able to control their emotions. And we live in a complex, dynamic system. There are so many different things that trigger people, whether it's lack of, family structure, breaking down, video games, whatever it is. I mean, there's so many different things. And so we've got to be able to get under control. But on another note, do you know who else was from Uvalde, Texas?
Who?
John Nance Garner, Dan. Do you remember him? Vice President.
FDR VP, yeah.
Yeah, he said that famously said the vice presidency was worth a warm bucket of spit and a couple other different.
And Kamala Harris has proved him right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I thought of that connection when she was speaking yesterday and her completely vacuous and vapid answer that she provided in reaction.
Yeah, very good. So, thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So last night, as we talked a bit, previewing it yesterday, two separate debates, even though there are only six Republican gubernatorial candidates in Illinois. One was NBC5's, and then an hour later, you had WGN's. The first one, NBC5, was Richard Ervin with former State Senator Paul Schimpf and Max Solomon. The WGN debate was Rabine, Bailey, and Sullivan.
And listen to what a liar Richard Ervin is.
Hopefully, they will show on the stage the next time we meet, and that's going to be with ABC on June 2nd. So I look forward to being there and debating me on stage.
Acting like, oh, he's the victim. You know, they did. I'm leading in the polls, allegedly, that they were too afraid to come on stage with me. That is such bull jive. What does anybody know what the heck happened here?
Yeah, apparently Ken Griffin bought NBC5, as far as I can tell.
I don't know if that's confirmed,
but I don't know how Marianne Ahern and NBC5 can take themselves seriously when they host a gubernatorial debate with one of the front runners and two people who didn't even qualify for the WGN debate because they're at less than 5% in the polls. I don't know how they take themselves seriously because that was not a serious form. I mean, Marianne did an okay job, especially compared to those two nitwits that presided over the forum at WGN.
Micah and Tamon Bradley?
Yes, those two nitwits. And we'll get to them in a second. But
everybody's even finger pointing.
Why isn't this Mr. Ervin here? I mean, I think this is tough for a person that's a Democrat to actually be debating in a Republican atmosphere.
Well, it's actually a shame that Richard Ervin chose not to be here tonight because I was actually looking forward to having a conversation with him face to face.
Yeah, Rabine and Bailey.
Right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was just I'm flipping back and forth. Like, who's lying here?
Well,
I'd have to say, unless this is a miscommunication, Dan.
First of all, I don't want to dwell too much on this,
yeah,
but
I'm
how do two news outlets not get together and say we're going to have debates on different days and then, you know, prevent any of this gamesmanship and this hiding by Ervin? I mean, NBC5
saying they didn't have studio space. Bull jive. They have plenty of studios, Dan.
NBC5 basically aided and abetted Ervin's ability to dodge having to confront the three other candidates who actually have a chance in this race. Mm-hmm. So that's on NBC5.
Well, their response was, "Well, that's the only time we can get the studio space."
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
Over a 6-month primary campaign, that is not a credible defense for what they did. But even still. Even with home cooking, courtesy of NBC5, Richard Ervin
was horrible.
Had all kinds of trouble on whether or not to eliminate the FOID card in Illinois. This is Ervin's answer.
The FOID card system in Illinois is broken. You know, I can say, you know, specifically my FOID card expired during COVID. It took me a year to get another one. The system's broken and definitely needs to be fixed, but we need background checks to ensure that guns don't get into the hands of criminals and folks with mental illnesses and make it harder for us to protect our residents.
See, that's the sort of fork-tongued response you get from Ervin on every answer, and I've got more examples. Everybody gets a background check. It's federal law.
It's federal, right.
So if I go buy a gun in Illinois, even if I didn't have a FOID card, I'm still getting a background check. Ervin knows that, but he wants to have it both ways. Illinois is only one of four states that have a FOID card requirement for law-abiding gun owners. But he doesn't want to come out against it because, you know, they're already measuring the drapes over in Camp Ervin for, well, not just for the general, for the mansion, I'm sure, because of they think that Ken Griffin's money absolves all of their sins and all of his and eliminates all of his character flaws. I don't think so. Ervin I mean, it just continues. If you like that answer, you're going to love Irvin on abortion. Here we go again.
Oh, listen, I'm pro-life, you know, but to comment on this leaked draft from the Supreme Court.
Don't
that is
the
not
voters
the final
have
decision,
a right to know where you stand?
It's irresponsible for me to compromise. I'm a lawyer. You
it's
know,
irresponsible, though, lawyer. Some would say, to not take a stand. Voters want to know where you stand.
The stand will happen once an actual draft comes
that
down.
Will but be let me, after the primary.
Let me tell you what I'm hearing as I ride throughout, as I drive throughout the state and talk to many voters, whether it be in Chicagoland.
Yeah, and then he goes on with his, you know, typical ham-handed pivot. To, you know, I'm hearing voters talk about breadbasket issues and blah, blah, blah.
She tried. Marianne tried.
She did push back on that. That was good. Here's the Black Lives Matter question for all three candidates. So you'll hear from Schimpf. You'll hear from Max Solomon very succinctly. And then you'll hear Richard Irvin prattle on with his forked tongue.
Mr. Solomon.
No.
Mr. Schimpf.
No.
Mr. Irvin.
You know, I think we all agree that black people's lives matter, but all lives matter. Black, white, Latino, Indian, Asian, and black lives matter no more, no less, have to be included in all lives.
But can you explain why you emphasize all lives matter? Do you believe in the Black Lives Matter movement?
We are the United States of America. We've got to start acting united.
So you don't believe in the Black Lives Matter movement?
I believe that black lives, black people's lives matter, just like all lives matter.
In fairness...
This is Schimpf.
When you talk about Black Lives Matter, you know, it's are you talking about the entire institutional movement, what that organization has stood for?
The question is, do you support Black Lives Matter?
I believe that just like when people say that rainforests matter, it's true. Okay, but I do not agree with the methods and the goals of that organization.
Yeah, obviously they're talking about the organization, Paul. I mean, come on. Yes, nobody disagrees with small b, small l, small m, Black Lives Matter. Yes. I mean, it's just such an asinine parsing. Yes, we're talking about the Marxist organization funded by corporate America that Richard Irvin supports passionately and enthusiastically that was the proximate party to the destruction of American cities in the summer of 2020. Yeah, that Black Lives Matter. Are we clear now? I love this, like being obtuse. And by the way, the other three candidates, when they had the Black Lives Matter, other WGN, I mean, they sort of vomited all over themselves, too. What is complicated about this? I did not exactly see a lot of William F. Buckley's on stage, either stage last night. I got to tell you, pretty disappointing. They start with not understanding. Particularly at the WGN debate, you don't start from the premises of leftist moderators trying to push their left on you. And I'm talking to Gary Rabine, I'm talking to Darren Bailey, and to a lesser extent, actually, I'm talking to Jesse Sullivan. So there's Irvin on the Foyd cart, Irvin on abortion, Irvin on
BLM.
How about Irvin on COVID policies?
The state had a mask mandate. We did not have a mask mandate. The state did. J.B. Pritzker had a mask mandate.
Well, you had one in Aurora
as
well.
And we did not. No, we didn't.
There was a time when you encouraged businesses and said there would be fines if they didn't follow.
No, that was J.B. Pritzker's mandate. In matter of fact, he put it on Aurora to give
you warned businesses if customers were not wearing them, they would be fines.
As I said, you know, when J.B. Pritzker, you know, tried to force municipalities like Chicago to have a vaccine mandate, many did, just like Chicago, and fired a number of firemen, fired police officers. You know, in my case, I did not have a vaccine mandate. And
Okay. Is everything that comes out of his mouth a lie?
Yes.
And good for Marianne Ahern for pushing back on him yet again. He's a flim flam man. I told Tamon and Marianne when we were trying to get Richard Irvin, everyone was trying to interview him. I go, do you understand he is not a Republican? And Tamon Bradley, oh no, he is. Like, Tamon, he is not a Republican. He's getting paid to do this.
Well, because he's slightly to the right of Tamon Bradley, who's a Marxist. So I guess he considers him a Republican. Irvin had a vax mandate on city employees in Aurora, did he not?
Yes, he did.
He just said he didn't have a vaccine.
Well, he's lying. He's such a sack of, you know what? Mm-hmm. God.
Irvin and the others on Sanctuary State, working with ICE, because, you know, the Democrat Socialists don't want state or local resources used to facilitate ICE immigration law enforcement.
Listen, immigration is an issue that definitely needs to be dealt with by the federal government because the federal government has jurisdiction over it. We need to secure our borders, and I think we can all agree that this particular administration has done a terrible job securing our borders.
So what about...
Uh-huh. And he said there would be no sanctuary state. Aurora's not a sanctuary city, and there would be no sanctuary state with a Governor Irvin.
I don't believe him. Because he's lying about everything else. Why would anybody trust him?
Well, you shouldn't, because he's already taken a position on the issue. June 23rd of 2019, Richard Irvin, in a statement, joining Governor J.B. Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot in, quote, prohibiting the use of our resources to aid or support ICE in its enforcement activities, unquote. He continued, I fully support immigrant and refugee families who live in Aurora and object to any such raids that will separate families and traumatize entire segments of our community. Richard Irvin, of previous administration, praising Governor Rauner's sanctuary state legislation, quote, it's just the right, it is the right, just, and fair thing to do, unquote. But now he's against sanctuary state. Uh-huh. It would be nice if Marian Ahern or some of these other candidates would be as up to speed on the record of your competitors, plural, but specifically that competitor, as, say, I am. And then this moment, Irvin on boys and girls sports. Oh. You know, the Indiana State Legislature just overrode Holcomb's veto. Holcomb
Republican-led state, House and state in Indiana there overturned it. Good for them.
Holcomb embarrassed himself, and he's been embarrassing himself as a quote-unquote conservative governor of Indiana, and I do put it in quotes with him.
He's not conservative anymore.
So prohibiting boys from playing girls' sports, that was the question, and this is how that went with the three, Irvin, Schimpf, and Solomon.
The first agency of socialization for any child is their parent, and that's where it starts from.
Can I ask you all, should transgender girl athletes be banned from participating in women's sports? Mr. Irvin?
Each sport agency has to determine, you know, what's best for the competition and fairness in their particular agency.
So should transgender girl athletes be barred?
It's about fairness. You know, it's about making sure that these competitions are fair for everyone involved. So each organization, whether it be basketball, whether it be football, whether it be swimming, has to determine what is fair and who should compete.
But you don't want to have a say in what is
fair. It should be totally local. And the governor should not have a say. You know, this shouldn't be something we legislate from the governor's office. This should be something we determine that parents and the local school districts are allowed to make for themselves.
That's not a leader, not at all.
How does that work?
Yeah, CPS is going to decide. Each sport, so if you're in wrestling. Where do you have girls wrestling?
Well, he just said local decision. Parents and school districts. So CPS says that boys can play girls' sports, and then they go play a school, one of the CPS schools goes to play a school in the suburbs that doesn't allow boys to play girls' sports. So how does that work?
Yeah. Those non-conference games can get a little sticky.
Mm-hmm. Or even within district.
Yeah, that too.
If it's just going to be local parents with a local school or school district, I guess if he said school district, then it would be district-wide policy. But yeah, district by district in the suburbs, you know, the Naperville School District and the Wheaton-Warrenville South District, what if they have different policies? So they just abide their different policies? Well, what if one objects to the other's policy? Then they
forfeit the game?
I mean, forfeits, or they don't play anymore, or what? You want a statewide patchwork based on... No.
No, that's not how that works.
This is why you've had states that are actually led by conservatives who aren't trying to middle every issue, who aren't trying to placate Marxists they think they can pull over to their side in a general election.
That's why they moved the integrity of women's sports.
Which is why they moved it at the state level. It's the legislated from the governor's office. No, it comes in legislative form, and it's sent to the governor's office for signature. But Richard Irvin doesn't want that on his desk.
Richard Irvin doesn't care about female athletes.
So we got boys and girls sports. He's punting on that. We got Sanctuary State. He's lying about that. We got mask and vax mandates. He's lying about that. We got the BLM question. He's bobbing and weaving that. Mm-hmm. You got abortion. He won't take a position until the Supreme Court promulgates the Dobbs opinion formally. Mm-hmm. And he says the FOID card system is broken, but he won't agree with the other candidates that it should be eliminated altogether. Yeah. There's your conservative standard bearer. Are you serious? Are you serious with this guy? Pete in Montgomery.
Good morning, Dan. So I don't really think Irvin has been fully red-pilled. But the way where you're attacking him is entirely, I don't want to say over the top because he's running for office, but it does impact other people who we are trying to red pill when you're not giving them at least some credit for trying to come to our side.
I just went through issues. So those issues that was unfair? It was an unfair characterization of his view.
I'm not talking about Richard Irvin's view. I'm talking about the overall tone of somebody getting red-pilled. When we convert people to being conservatives, they don't always come over all in all at once. That's all I'm saying.
Well,
I may not be all in all at once.
I agree with that, but you think that this is somebody who's slowly having an awakening, or you think this is somebody that's seizing on a political opportunity because he's got $45 million behind him.
He's seizing on a political opportunity.
Right.
The first rule is to not trust politicians, no matter what side they're on.
Right.
That's the first rule. But getting people to come to our side is the second rule, because the other side is destroying everything.
Well, I thanks for the copy. I mean, I agree with that, but somebody who is wrestling with issues. Or like we had Betsy from the North Side, agrees with us on Second Amendment rights, disagrees with us on she's pro-choice, so she disagrees with me on abortion, for example. But we have a conversation, and she's like saying, here's where I've moved, or here's where I think about this, and here's where we disagree. That's not what Richard Irvin's doing. He's taking one position, then he's taking another, sometimes in real time, depending on the audience. That's not honest.
He's flat out lying about mask mandates and fines that were going to be implemented. You can Google it. Richard Irvin.
So somebody being red-pilled is having a frank conversion, or at least a frank questioning of positions on particular issues. And then you go back and forth about where they are and why they're moving or why they're questioning. And you go back and forth on the substance of it. But that's not what you're getting here. No, this isn't somebody being red-pilled. This is somebody who's blue-pilling the electorate. George and Monique.
Hey, Dan, I don't know if Irvin's going to be a good governor or not, but he's one hell of a tap dancer.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call. Right. Gregory Hines has nothing on him. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, continuing our discussion of yesterday night's GOP governor debates, plural.
Yeah, because God forbid if all six of them were on the same thing. They could have done a dual broadcast and, had it simultaneously both on Channel 5 and Channel 9, but nope. They had two separate ones.
The one in which Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin participated in, including former State Senator Paul Schimpf and Attorney Max Solomon. Schimpf and Irvin are also attorneys. There was an interesting juxtaposition of views, I thought, on a question Marianne Ahern asked about Ukrainian refugees. Would the candidates support using state resources to help Ukrainian refugees relocating to Illinois, at least temporarily, because of the war in their country. And listen to the response from Schimpf and Irvin side by side.
But we're not talking about that part. We're just talking about whether or not, while they're here, would you assist them with taxpayer funds?
No.
It seems as if you just discovered that right now.
No.
Yes.
No.
And Mr. Schimpf.
The United States is the beacon of freedom for the world. Illinois is the greatest state in our great country. I would support any refugees that were coming here legally from Ukraine. That is who we are as a people. We will provide the shelter that it talks about on our Statue of Liberty.
And Mr. Solomon, which yes.
Go ahead. Finish the question. And can I just
yes,
say,
Mr.
you know,
Irvin,
and the reason I say no is because of what I stated earlier, that anything dealing with immigration is our should be federal funds used and not local funds used. So no state funds should be used for this. It should be federal funds.
Uh-oh. I can see the headline now. Richard Irvin doesn't like Ukrainians.
Trying to bail water after his initial caught off guard and then saying no and then wanting to say yes but not knowing how, so just offloading on the federal government. Well, you know, it turns out it's a funny thing. What you wish the federal government would do and what it actually does are two different things oftentimes. So if you don't get the support from the federal government you want when it comes to what they're doing at the southern border or what they're providing for Ukrainian refugees, the question is, what is governor you going to do? You know, because you're the executive of the state. Those are questions that stump Richard Irvin. By the way, I think this additional comparison is noteworthy. We just talked about it before the break. Irvin joins with J.B. Pritzker and Lightfoot in prohibiting the use of Aurora City resources to aid or support ICE in its enforcement activities. So he is getting involved, even though that's a federal government. So when it comes to people in this country illegally, he doesn't want any part of law enforcement. He also, as I said, praised Governor Rauner's signature on the sanctuary state legislation. It was the right and fair thing to do, while saying Aurora is not a sanctuary city and Illinois will not be a sanctuary state. Aurora was de facto a sanctuary city, and he supported Illinois becoming a sanctuary state. In addition to that, he opposes people coming to this country legally because they're fleeing persecution, you know, from invaders. So temporarily here legally, he won't lift a hand. But if you're here illegally, then he'll run interference with federal law enforcement for you. Hi. For more on this and other topics, we're pleased to be joined by former State Senator Paul Schimpf, Republican candidate for governor. You just heard there. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Do I have that sussed out about right with respect to trying to distill Richard Irvin's positions on these geopolitical matters that are visited upon Illinois?
Well, I think what you have accurately conveyed is that the Irvin campaign really doesn't want to take a position on stuff. Last night's debate was not as much about solutions for Illinois and how we're going to defeat J.B. Pritzker as much as getting oppo on the Republican candidates and putting us on the record on stuff. But there was a lack of specificity there.
What was your greatest moment last night?
So many
to
choose
from.
I don't know that I would ever
classify anything in a media circus as a greatest moment, Amy. But
or maybe your strongest moment.
What I tried to do was I tried to answer the questions. There was a point where candidates were talking about what the people of Illinois want. And what the people of Illinois want most right now is a leader who is simply going to answer questions. I'm still surprised that people are unwilling to simply explain or just say who they voted for president in the last several presidential elections.
Very complicated
elections.
Question, Paul. I mean, really? I'm being sarcastic.
It shouldn't be. Yeah, my opinion is if you're not willing to tell people who you voted for in a presidential election, you are not deserving of support. It's just that simple.
And the basis for – well, actually, one more debate question before we get into your campaign specifically. What was your takeaway for how this all transpired when you have two of the network affiliates or, you know, the superstation and a network affiliate doing the debate on the same night and not and three over here and three over there rather than everybody on the stage together and two separate debates, one at GN and one at NBC5? Why couldn't that get worked out?
What did you hear?
I don't know. That's something that I, when we were about 3 weeks out from this and we had committed to doing NBC5 and Telemundo just because we felt like that was an audience that I had not had as much exposure with. But I talked with my campaign manager and said, there is no way that they are going to continue having two separate competing debates on the same night. I don't think there's any way this is going to happen. You know, the media have to be able to figure this out. So I was shocked that this went forward with two separate debates. And as far as the media interactions that would lead to something that really does a disservice to the voters of Illinois, you probably have more insight than that. I really don't know what the media dynamics are at play.
Are you going to be at ABC7's June 2nd debate?
Yes, that is on our schedule. We have committed for that.
And so let's take a step back and just sort of give us the 101 answer. Why are you running? What's the basis of your candidacy?
Well, I'm running because Illinois needs common sense conservative leadership that we can trust. I'm also running because I want my two sons to grow up in an Illinois that is safe, prosperous, and free. I don't think that future is compatible with J.B. Pritzker in the governor's mansion. I believe that I give the people of Illinois the best opportunity to defeat J.B. Pritzker, because truly, if you're going to beat J.B. Pritzker in November, you are going to have to do three things. You're going to have to unify the Illinois Republican Party. You simply cannot win unless you have a unified Illinois Republican Party behind you. You're also going to have to get crossover votes. There are more Democrats than Republicans in Illinois. You have to get crossover votes. And then lastly, you are going to have to survive a $100 million character assassination that we all know is coming from J.B. Pritzker. I am the candidate of the six of us that are running that has the best chance to do those three things.
Why do you want to be governor, though? I mean, I know besides your family, I mean, it's where would you even begin? And with pension reform, with violence in Chicago, what would be the first on your priority list?
Well, my first priority is going to be reining in the Illinois administrative agencies. I am tired of administrative overreach. I want the administrative agencies in Illinois to get back to implementing the laws that are passed by the legislature, not making their own laws. I've really become very frustrated with the Illinois State Board of Education. They have completely lost sight of their mission statement to support local school boards. Instead, they think it's their job to supplant local school boards. We also have to have a governor that, frankly, is going to do something about the violence and crime that is out of control in our state. That is something that J.B. Pritzker has been missing in action on. I will be a presence on the streets of Chicago. I'm not going to be cuffing and stuffing people. That's not my job, but our law enforcement needs to know that they have a governor that unequivocally supports them. So really getting, you know, reining in the state administrative agencies, putting the weight of the governor's bully pulpit behind doing something about crime, and then also just enforcing some transparency in the legislative process. When I'm governor, it is not going to be business as usual under the Capitol Dome. I will veto any legislation that is not passed in a transparent manner. And what I'm talking about is just the most recent budget that was passed without people knowing what was in it. Those are all things that I will do to change the course of Illinois government and restore trust in government.
You know, the old saw goes that if people saw how laws were made, there would be a revolution. And we're trying to foment a revolution of sorts in this state. From your time in the state Senate, what is one thing you'd like to communicate, or you do communicate on the trail to voters, about how Springfield operates that they don't have a full, you don't think they have a full appreciation for, that you couldn't have a full appreciation for unless you were actually there witnessing it?
When I was in Springfield, one of the things that just absolutely opened my eyes that I was surprised by is how little transparency there is in the legislative process. You look at the Safety Act, HB 3653, which you guys have talked about with your listeners ad nauseum, but that is more the norm than people realize. I mean, we talk about how what a travesty it was that it was voted on in the Illinois Senate at 4 a.m. in the morning and nobody knew what was in the legislation. There is actually quite a bit of legislation that gets passed, that gets voted on without elected officials knowing fully what is in there. And certainly the public and the advocacy groups don't know what's in there because you have floor amendments that can completely change a bill right before it is voted on. After it's already had a committee hearing, it can be changed right at the last minute. That's usually what happens in the budget process, and that's what happens a lot of times with controversial bills. So it is something that a governor can inject transparency into the process by not being hesitant to use a veto. And one of the things that I have promised the people of Illinois is that I will veto any legislation that is not passed in a transparent manner, even if I agree with it. The process is that important. If we're ever going to trust our government again, we have to legislate in a trustworthy manner. One of the things that I've said is, you know, it comes down to the voters. You know, if we want more transparency and less backroom dealing, that starts by rejecting candidates that are selected via backroom dealing. If you want less influence on money in politics, you know, start by supporting candidates that are not being bankrolled by billionaires. It's really not that difficult.
I got to raise this issue. We disagree on the public sector pension issue, and it was raised again in the debate last night. We have for some time, which is fine. But you told the audience yesterday you don't support amending the pension clause in the Illinois Constitution. But, you know, explain why there should be a floor on public sector pension benefits, but not a ceiling.
Well, the problem with our pensions and the thing that really drives my motivation on this issue is that we are in this massive pension shortfall, which we definitely have one. It's unsustainable what we have right now. But we are in this position because the legislature, the Illinois politicians, stole from the pension funds. That is the number one driver for the pension shortfall, is the fact that we have taken pension holidays. And we have had opportunities to try to rectify that shortfall in recent history. J.B. Pritzker's first budget, we had record revenue coming in to the state. And what did we do? Instead of trying to pay down that shortfall, we increased spending across the board. You look at our most recent budget that was just passed. You know, once again, we had a windfall thanks to the bailout from the federal government, and we didn't take advantage of that opportunity. In our country, you know, we have, you know, one of our foundational principles is that we believe that it's more important to protect the innocent than it is to punish the guilty. There is abuse in our pension system, no doubt about it. But we need to make sure that we are protecting the retired teachers, the retired police officers who paid into the system and do not have exorbitant pensions. They have pensions that are fair based on their service. And I believe that we need to ensure that we do that. The pension protection clause that is in the Illinois Constitution does that. And I'm not convinced that we can't eventually get this problem solved without tampering with the Illinois Constitution. This is not something that is going to be solved, you know, in just a few years. We've been digging this hole for three decades. It is going to probably take at least a decade for us to get, you know, back in a solvent position.
But I think we have to figure out whether or not it's just the pension holidays, which you're right about, or it's conferring benefits that could never be paid under any circumstances. And fact is that over the 30 years between 88 and 2018, the pension funds, in terms of the accrued liabilities, have grown at 8.5% annually. The increase, 1,146% over that 30-year period. Compare that to state personal income, which is a proxy for GDP, it grew at one-fifth that rate. So if you have pension obligations growing at five times the rate of income growth, state personal income growth, over a 30-year period, how can you ever catch up? That seems to me you're conferring liabilities you simply cannot pay.
Well, when I was a member of the pensions working, when I was a member of the pensions working group, which is where my knowledge comes from, I'm not a CPA or an actuarian. My undergraduate degree was in mechanical engineering, and then I went to law school. But the what I was told by the experts is the two drivers of the pension shortfall were the pension holidays was the number one driver. The number two driver was this compound cost of living adjustment. And I agree with you in terms of, I believe that from a legal standpoint, this compound cost of living adjustment, especially on pensions that are already six figures, to use the legal term, I believe it's substantively unconscionable. An unconscionable contract is a contract where the courts say, look, the benefits are just too one-sided in this contract for us to ever enforce it. Mm-hmm. I would be willing to look at, saying that, okay, the compound cost of living adjustment doesn't kick in once you reach a certain point. If you have a pension that, say, is $150,000, guess what? No more compound cost of living adjustment. I think that would survive judicial scrutiny without amending the Illinois Constitution. So there are, the number one driver is the fact that there were pension holidays, but I do recognize that this compound cost of living adjustment is something that is a problem as well.
He is Paul Shim, former state senator, Republican candidate for governor. For more information on his campaign, that's Shimp, the number 4, Illinois.com, S-C-H-I-M-P-F, 4, Illinois.com is the website. Paul Shim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Dan and Amy. Enjoyed the discussion this morning.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
And Amy, so the election results yesterday and Florida, excuse me, in Georgia and Texas and elsewhere were, of course, subordinated to the horrific events in Uvalde, Texas, with the 19 children who were murdered and the two teachers murdered by that gunman. Mike Scott's keeping you updated on that as we get more information from law enforcement on what transpired and try to make more sense of it.
And earlier in the show, we had a man named David who's now lives in Mount Prospect, but he was born there and went to that high school. And back then it was fourth and fifth grade. Now it's second, third, and fourth. And I said, well, why weren't the doors locked? And he goes, there's some schools that it's open-air school, so you'll have classrooms, but the hallways are actually outdoor spaces. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's the situation there. So in all the shooting, according to CNN, they just said that all the victims were in one classroom as well as those two teachers who died.
Well, we'll continue to update that story and talk a little more about it a little bit later on the program. But now we turn our attention to those election results, as well as the continued stagflation and shortages that punctuate the Biden administration. Steve Moore joins us, economist and GovZilla author. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hi. Good morning, guys.
Morning. So the results, there was nothing particularly surprising last night, but, you know, you've had your hand in electoral politics before. How confident are you about the Kemp-Herschel Walker ticket delivering Georgia in the fall?
Well, let's talk for a minute about that Kemp versus Perdue race. And, you know, by the way, David Perdue was a very good free market guy in the United States Senate, one of my favorite senators. And he came with, people should remember that he came within 1,500 votes or something like that of winning outright. Remember, they had that runoff in Georgia because he got like 49.9% of the vote and he needed to get 50% plus one vote to get, and you know, to win it outright. And so he was kind of a victim of this craziness that happened after the election. And then Trump, you know, and look, I've worked for Trump. I love the guy. I think he did an amazing job at our economy. But everything with him is so personal when it comes to these election outcomes. And he hated Kemp because Kemp did not call for the kind of overturning of the election results that Trump wanted. Now, do I think there was hanky-panky in those elections in Georgia? I absolutely do. But I think Kemp did pretty much the right thing. And what was really interesting is that the voters, it was a, I mean, it was a blowout. Avalanche for Kemp.
More
I mean,
than
50 a total
points.
Blowout.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did Trump take a little bit of a walloping yesterday in Georgia? He sure did. And so that, you know, questions how much, you know, whether voters are kind of drifting away from him a little bit in the Republican Party.
But is this good news for Governor DeSantis, though, in case he wants to run against Trump in 2024?
Well, that's the big question, Amy. I mean, nobody knows quite what's going to happen. Those are the two titans right now in the Republican Party. DeSantis, of course, is the great governor of Florida who has been amazing. I mean, he's been incredible what he's done in Georgia. I mean, in this great state of Florida. It did not shut down the way Illinois and a lot of blue states did, and it got through COVID just fine. So nobody quite knows what – although I did talk to DeSantis a few months ago, and his position has pretty much been, if Trump's running, I'm not running. Because, you know, Trump is still the 800-pound gorilla in the Republican field. And so that's that. Now, Herschel Walker is an interesting one. I mean, for those, you know, who know Georgia, I mean, Herschel Walker is a living legend in the state of Georgia. They love their football. And but I've met Herschel. He's a great guy. He's very, you know, he's very sensible. He's very you know, common sense when it comes to good policy. So on the economics, I think he'd be a great governor. And I mean, a senator. And of course, that's again. What's the name of the Democrat again?
Warnock.
Ralph Warnock.
Warnock. You know, Warnock has been a complete left wing, crazy, way out of touch. I mean, he might be elected in Illinois, but you wouldn't expect someone like that to be elected in Georgia. So I think the Republicans are going to sweep both of those races.
You know, the Kemp thing, though, Kemp versus Perdue, I don't know how much I read into that as a repudiation of Trump. I mean, I think Trump matters when you don't necessarily have a record. So he mattered for J.D. Vance
That's
in
true.
Ohio. He mattered for Oz in Pennsylvania. Yeah. You know, Kemp has been a good governor of Georgia,
exactly.
And so I appreciate Trump, but hey, I like Kemp, and he's done a good job, so we're staying the course in Georgia.
I completely agree with that. I mean, Kemp has been a very good governor, so people would say, well, why would we change horses right now? And the only people who, you know, voted, you know, for Perdue in that race against the incumbent was people who were just, you know, totally, you know, behind Trump and didn't really care about Kemp's record. But he was a good governor. I agree with that. If I had been in Georgia, and I like Perdue, I would have voted for Kemp as well. But, you know, look, here's the other thing that's happening that's really interesting that the press isn't paying attention to, guys. We've now had about 12 or 13 states that have had primaries now. And in every one of them, the Republican turnout on average has been about 35% above what it was 4 years ago. But the Democratic turnout is actually flat or negative. So that augurs very well for a big, big blowout in November for the Republicans. If, you know, this is feeling a lot like 1994 and 2010, where any candidate with a D next to their name is in big, big trouble. So we'll see. You know, the other interesting race, by the way, was down there on the border in Texas, where apparently these two candidates are about 200 votes.
177 right now. I'm keeping it because he's the last. Well, he's the last pro-life Democrat, and AOC and the squad has put up a candidate to run against him.
Yeah, and what's interesting, you know, is that if the incumbent Democrat, who's a kind of moderate Democrat, loses, then I'll tell you, I think Republicans are going to pick up that seat. Republicans have been doing very well in Texas with Hispanic voters. That's a totally Hispanic district. And so keep your eyes on that one. But look, the big story right now, other than this tragic shooting, is what's happening with the energy markets. And I don't know if you guys saw what Biden said the other day. It's gotten a lot of attention, where he basically said, oh, yeah, high gas prices. This is just the price we have to pay and the pain we have to pay for what did he call it? The
transformation.
I have it here. Can we play it? We haven't played it yet because he's, you know, unapologetic about the soaring gas prices.
Yeah. When it comes to the gas prices, we're going through an incredible transition that is taking place that, God willing, when it's over, will be stronger and the world will be stronger and less reliant on fossil fuels.
We knew it was coming, right, Stephen Moore?
Yeah, exactly. How many times have I said this over the last year and 3 months on your show? I mean, it's probably every week that when Joe Biden, when he's talking about out of the other side of his mouth, and he keeps saying, we are doing everything we can to reduce gas prices. You know, how many times have they said that's just a lie? Why don't they at least admit it? They hate fossil fuels. They don't want people to use fossil fuels. By the way, they hate cars. Their grand plan is to get everybody, you're in the car right now, get out of your car. They don't want you driving your car. You've got to get mass transit. That's their transportation dream that everybody crams into subway cars and buses. And so he finally admitted, this is the plan, folks. High gas prices, this is the plan.
And, Steve, will you be addressing the Davos, the World Economic Forum in Davos this weekend? Are you on the schedule?
You know, what's so interesting about Davos is I did go to Davos back in 2017. And it's a kind of quick, funny story that I got a call from these folks in Switzerland literally 3 weeks before the conference, you know, and they said, well, we want you to come out to the Davos conference. And I said, God, I'm not, Switzerland, it's, you know, 3 weeks away. You're just calling me now. So they said, well, how much would it cost to, you know, get you to come out here? And you know, I had a bunch of other things I had to do. It was the transition when Trump had won the election between then and his inauguration. So I finally said, well, look, pay me X. I mean, a huge amount of money. I had 5 times more money than I would normally, you know, get for a speech. And I said, okay, if you'll pay me that, I'll come out there. Well, the next day they called me and said, okay, we'll pay your fee. So I went out and I finally realized when I got out there why they were, you know, wanted me so badly. They had lined up all the Hillary Clinton people because they obviously they thought that Hillary was going to win the election. So they didn't have any Trump people lined up, and I was the only Trump person they could find who could come out there. And I get out there, and it was the most amazing conference. The thing, they were all kind of Euro bureaucrats, you know, these elitist, you know, CEOs of companies and so on. And I learned two things. There are two things that these people in Davos hated. They hated Brexit, and they hated Trump. And so they just couldn't get over it that this guy was going to be president of the United States. But these are people who fly in on their private planes, these hooty-tooty, you know, Euro bureaucrats and the CEOs, and they talk about how much they care about climate change. That's what these people do. They're the biggest hypocrites I've ever seen.
Well, we're glad you got some money out of them, at least. Steve Moore, economist and Govzilla author. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, see ya.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So returning to what happened yesterday in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 children, grades 2 to 4, and two adults, two teachers, were murdered by a former student there who's now 18 years old. And he was in turn stopped, killed by a Border Patrol agent who happened to be working the area and heroically interceded to stop and prevent more people to stop him and prevent more people from being killed.
What happened prior was he shot his grandmother, and then police came to respond, and there was a police chase that ensued, and he rolled his truck over right in front of the school and then ran into the school. And according to CNN and other sources, he went into one classroom and killed 19 second, third, and fourth graders and two teachers.
And the big guy, upon returning from Asia, addressed the nation last night, saying the following.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done? I am sick and tired of it. We have to act. And don't tell me we can't have an impact on this carnage. I spent my career as a senator and a vice president working to pass common sense gun laws. We can and won't prevent every tragedy, but we know they work and have positive impact. When we passed the assault weapons ban, mass shootings went down. When the law expired, mass shootings tripled. The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong. What in God's name do you need an assault weapon for except to kill someone? Deer aren't running through the forest with Kevlar vests on, for God's sake. It's just sick. And the gun manufacturers have spent two decades aggressively marketing assault weapons, which make them the most and largest profit. For God's sake, we have to have the courage to stand up to the industry.
Stand up to the gun lobby. That's what we can do to affect the incidents of mass shooting, says the big guy. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll cede my time, and part of my time at least, in reacting to the big guy's comments. To Glenn Greenwald, journalist, who was on with Tucker last night. Here was his reaction to what the president said.
I was really hoping that he would strike exactly that note as somebody who has twice had to bury a child. He could really empathize with,
yes,
in a unique way, with how uniquely heinous it is. He could talk about the spirituality of our society and the need to unite on what obviously, you know, everyone, no matter what your partisan perspective is, reacts in the same way when seeing this sort of thing. And he spent about 6 seconds doing that and then immediately did a detour to figure out how he could squeeze and exploit the situation for partisan advantage. It was so grotesque and, I mean, unsurprising, but also really disappointing to watch.
Relax. I mean, if he brought up that his daughter was killed violently and just in a moment, like, he never saw her again, Republicans would be all over him saying, oh, see, he's politicizing the moment. I could tell that he was hurting. And Jill Biden was hurting, because everybody should be hurting right now if you have a heart in your body. A second, third, and fourth graders getting gunned down. The most innocent people in the most pristine setting where they think that they're safe. Nothing President Biden could say or do would stop people from saying they're politicizing this. And then Laura Ingraham's on there saying, why isn't he in Chicago? You know, there's deaths there every week, every day. He should, you know, what about the kids in Chicago? This is different, because there was an expectation of safety because they were in a school in a small town, a farming community, 60 miles from the border.
Oh, so in Chicago, you shouldn't have an expectation of
do you have an expectation of safety? I don't anymore. I don't think anybody. You're not safe anywhere at any time of the day in any neighborhood in Chicago.
All right,
the Gold Coast.
Now, can I ask my question?
Yeah.
So should kids on a playground in Chicago have an expectation of safety? Or they shouldn't?
I wish that they could. Right. As a parent, no, I don't think anyone's safe anywhere.
So what does that say?
that we live in an America that I never thought we would live in.
So how is that different? They should have an expectation. Right. They should have an expectation of safety in that grammar school in Uvalde. And you should have an expectation of safety on a playground in Chicago or a school in Chicago. But you don't. So how is it different?
Maybe they're, I don't know.
Right. Joe Biden could have.
What would you have liked Joe Biden to say?
I'm
just asking.
I don't look for to politicians to, you know, address my feelings.
Okay.
But in that moment, you know, the intelligent politician, the sincere politician, talks about what happened, does not put in a plug for a particular legislation. You don't know all that went into what happened yesterday. You don't go on your standard issue riffs. The things he said yesterday are things we've heard him say all the time. They're totally platitudinous for him, and they're also completely inaccurate. The data he cites is inaccurate about the assault weapon bans. So rather than, yes, bring the nation together, sort of speak, by just focusing on what happened to those families, what happened to that community, what the federal government can do to provide assistance to get as many answers as we can and share them so that we try to develop a better working knowledge of how to address these horrific events that happen with frequency. I don't know what contextual.
Well, just we've had 900 school shootings since Sandy Hook.
Yeah, but the way even that's categorized, you know,
right.
As somebody brings a gun to school and it goes off or something like this, or there was a school, somebody fired a shot on the school grounds, the way that's categorized. Sandy Hook, this are completely different, obviously. And we haven't had, one is too many, but this is not happening every other day. But there is something afoot in our culture that needs to be addressed. And it's not going to be addressed by anybody's singular piece of legislation. That's what we know will not work. And so why not broaden it and have a deeper conversation where people think about, reflect on it themselves, and maybe look into their own hearts a little bit about what kind of society we're living in, as opposed to playing Capitol Hill politics, which is what he did in those remarks. Weak. Because he's weak. And he always has been. Rob in Ukrainian Village. Help me with Rob in Ukrainian Village.
Yep. Are you there?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah, what happens horrible. Children are the most innocent, pure, you know, people on earth. When are the politicians going to, you know, look at this as a mental health issue? I mean, go into a child's school and do that is someone who's sick in their head. It's not a gun thing. It's somebody who's literally sick in their head to go in and intentionally want to do that to children. You know, I'm old enough to remember when they wanted to put parental advisories on CDs for language. Now kids can go into these virtual reality video games and shoot up stores and schools and all that stuff, and there's no talk on that. So, you know, that and, you know, let's get back to families and parenting and, you know, the family core.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Appreciate it. So, yeah, I mean, that's part of that reflection I'm talking about, you know, thinking about what you can do and how you want to address this topic that's going to be, you know, everywhere within your social circles. There's something else, too. You know, the mental illness invocation, we talked about a bit earlier in the show. It's really complicated.
It is. Like, at what level do you put them on a database? You know,
do you have to be
diagnosed by a professional? Then you get on a database that then goes to the gun shops to say, you know, you're this person you should not sell a weapon to.
Yeah, but also, too, I mean, you know, the other side is if you start putting people who are diagnosed schizophrenics in a database, you're going to hear from the other side about privacy rights, about people being stigmatized. Because even those who have a diagnosed mental disorder, you got a problem again. And the problem is that most do not commit acts of violence. So is there among particular diagnoses of particular mental afflictions, is there a higher propensity than somebody without that affliction? There is. So it's not something that shouldn't be addressed, but it requires nuance, something that most politicians aren't very good at, and something that we're not very good at in this country when it comes to debate and dialogue and thinking through policy response.
What do we do with 18-year-olds who post pictures with their weapons and their extended magazine clips on their lap and all that? What to do with that? And then he asked this one woman, you know, a few days, well, like half a month ago, to, you know, repost my gun pics, and, you know, I wanted to tag you on this. Be grateful I tagged you. And she said, why? And then he said, you know, I got a little secret I want to tell you, and then left the conversation.
Okay. So there again, what sort of social media minding do you want, and by whom should it be done? I mean, you already have the censorious left that controls all these big social media platforms. What do you want to layer in?
They might want to look at mental health issues and, you know, teenage angst before looking at conservatives and trying to cancel them.
And somebody with a art history undergrad from Vassar can diagnose mental illness through social media posts and decide who should be flagged and sent over to the authorities and who shouldn't be. What's the diagnostic manual they'll be working off of? And how are those people trained to be able to distinguish threats from non-threats? This is not saying I don't want people paying attention and don't say something if you see something. But it's saying that this is just so much more complicated than just saying, this is what we do. We just point that finger and say, well, this is what we do if we just do this, if we just address mental illness, if we throw some money at it, if we just ban this person or monitor those people or create a list of these people, then it just goes away. No, it doesn't.
Or go from a 3-day to a 10-day background check, which I don't know what good that's going to do.
Theodore Dalrymple, since I mentioned him earlier when we were talking about who's a psychiatrist who worked in prisons, and he's also a great commentator and writer. He's written quite a bit about this. One of the things he wrote about, and this was after two mass shootings that were in close proximity just 3 years ago, probably remember them, the mass shooting in Dayton where 9 were killed, I think it was 9, and then just earlier, I think that may have been the same day or within 24 hours, the shooting in El Paso where 20 people were killed.
23. It was at the Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And they were targeted because they were Mexican.
Right.
Heartbreaking.
He writes, the role of imitation, the commission of acts of violence by the susceptible has been known since at least the end of the 18th century, when romantic young men in Europe committed suicide after the publication of Goethe's novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, where the eponymous hero Werther killed himself for unrequited love. Even today, a suicide in a soap opera is sometimes followed by a brief spate of suicides, such that producers are now wary of depicting suicides for fear of being accused of provoking them. We've talked about this before in the context of suicide as well as these mass shootings. Often these mass shootings is suicide by police, you know, with vengeance carried out by the shooter against society as a whole. But where the Tribune, for example, didn't used to publish the names, maybe that's still their protocol, publish the names of suicide victims for exactly this reason, the recognition of the power of the issue of imitation, the power of suggestion. He goes on, Dalrymple, modern mass killing, usually though not always by shooting, seems to have started with the case of Charles Whitman, you know, the Texas clock tower shooter, killed 16 and injured 44. That's 50 years ago now. That case has intrigued doctors ever since because at postmortem, Whitman was found to have a brain tumor, which might or might not have caused the removal of his normal inhibition against killing. Mm. In any case, he had undergone a character change before he killed. Mass shooters tend to be of above average intelligence, but not high achievers. In a society in which fame, recognition, and success are of capital importance, in which lives of quiet desperation are not a la mode, they often feel deeply wounded, insulted, in fact, by the supposed failure of society to take them at their own estimate to recognize their true worth. They are rarely at ease in their personal relationships either, but they look outward, not inward, for the source of their failures. The world for them is evil and unjust, and it will get at their hands what it deserves. In the process, of course, as another benefit, they will achieve their desired fame or notoriety, which is another reason why responsible outlets don't publish and repeat the names of the shooters. Don't give them the fame or notoriety.
Because that's what he wanted, I'm sure.
They will be the subject of articles, news items, a Wikipedia entry, perhaps even books. They will be an object of puzzlement by the learned and the famous. If they go far enough, they might even be mentioned by the President of the United States. Imitation, notoriety, vengeance, not necessarily mental illness. I mean, you know, of the order that you're thinking, like deranged, doesn't know right from wrong.
And I blame social media for all this. Even all those school fights you've been seeing at the suburban places and down, you know, in Steinmetz and all that gross graphic video. It's all about getting famous on Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat. It's all social media's fault. Part of it, I think
it's deeper than that because it happened before social media.
But did it happen to this extent?
Yeah.
Before social media?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Dalrymple, in his piece on imitation, offers this in conclusion. The significance of these killings goes far beyond the statistical likelihood of our being the victim of such a crime, which remains minimal. It's that they reveal to us the dark potential of the human soul. That's what's chilling about it. And that's why it registers in a way that your murder du jour on the streets of Chicago doesn't. Something more fundamental at work here. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A lot of angles to cover with respect to this horrific shooting at the elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. Taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text
line. And the anxious that parents and grandparents felt. This one grandpa was waiting outside all day. They caught up with him around midnight, still there, still waiting for answers, looking for his 10-year-old granddaughter.
I just took a little time to go to the hospital and see if we could find out anything over there, and nothing.
Oh, his poor face. And she was one of those 19 who was killed. And another who was killed was Javier Lopez, 10-year-old. His mom had just been at the school at an assembly celebrating his accomplishments, and here's his grandmother.
So it's so hard. You send your kids to school and thinking they're going to make it back home, and they're not.
And a lot of the parents had to submit DNA samples because the kids, they were unidentifiable. And
Michelle Dauber is a law professor at Stanford University. Incredibly, she is. Her reaction yesterday evening, as people are trying to make sense of the horrors that have just been committed. Does anyone know yet if Texas shooter was racially motivated? The NRA is pure evil. I say we blame this on Ted Cruz. That seems reasonable given his pandering to the gun lobby. It's a law professor at Stanford University. People want to try to have an intelligent discussion about something so important. It's difficult.
We're not going to say the 18-year-old gunman's name, but he's Hispanic, and most of his victims are Hispanic because most of that small town, tiny town, 60 miles from the border, 12,000 people live there are Hispanic.
Something else about race, since it was invoked for demagogic purposes by the left with the Buffalo supermarket shooting. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for it here if they can find it.
They're not going to find it.
Heather McDonald, writing at City Journal about hate crimes, the data, racially motivated hate crimes. In New York City from 2010 to 2020, blacks were 2.42 times as likely as whites to commit a hate crime among hate crime suspects whose race and ethnicity were known. Blacks in L.A. committed anti-Asian hate crimes at 4.8 times the rate of whites in 2021. Blacks in L.A. committed anti-gay hate crimes at 7 times the rate of whites and anti-Semitic hate crimes at 2.4 times the rate of whites. Blacks committed anti-trans hate crimes at 2.5 times the rate of Hispanics. There were no white suspects in anti-trans hate crimes in L.A. in 2021. Could go on to talk about the data. From 2016 to 2020, blacks nationally were twice as likely to commit a hate crime as white. That's according to FBI data. I don't want to get into the grouping by race that the left does, but if you want to play that game, then you have to address this data. With the white supremacy is lurking behind every corner, and you know, white cisgendered men are out hunting for minorities and marginalized people and so on and so forth. And they're responsible for, you know, all the ills in, of society, including racially motivated violence, including but not limited to mass shootings. It just doesn't bear out. Now, so if we can dispense with the lunacy of the left's argument, then we can get to maybe more thoughtful conversations that focus on all the unique aspects of each one of these situations and each one of these people who commit these atrocities against their fellow man. Maybe we could do that. But you got to get rid of all the nonsense from Stanford law professors and the entire political ruling class on the left side first, unfortunately. Ryan in New Lenox, here in Chicago's Morning Answer. Okay.
Can we take Ryan here?
Help me with Ryan.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. Look, the media and coverage angle is the tack I want to take on this. As soon as I saw the headline yesterday, the first thing that popped into my mind is, here we go again, because it's just rinse and repeat of all the same lines of argumentation. Thoughts and prayers are not enough. We need action. What kind of action? The action kind of action. The action that acts on action. That's what kind of action we need. Meanwhile, I have not heard a single elected official articulate a new law on the books that could have stopped this monster from doing what he did. The answer is almost always in the family and in enforcing laws currently on the books and dealing with people who are known entities to law enforcement, as you and Amy talk about on the show constantly. The worst take I saw, by the way, was Steve Kerr, a basketball coach, who has to descend to the locker room in front of the assembled press with all the tears and all the emotional pandering. What, since when do we need to hear from a basketball coach on a school shooting? How is that in any way productive?
Thanks for the call, Ryan, especially with what Kerr had to say. Yeah. I don't know. Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich, I think, are sharing a brain. They should get one that's functional. Verlon on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, I talk about this a lot, but every time I talk about it, I get pushback and people call in and say, well, they don't want their kids stigmatized. Well, let me tell you, since the late 80s, metal detectors and resource officers have been implemented in Chicago public schools and urban areas. There hasn't been one killing, one shooting inside the school. Can't solve what's happening on the outside of the schools, and it's not a lot of mass shootings in the suburbs. So let's concentrate on inside the schools. If that's a proven solution that's worked in the Chicago public schools, why do people push back on metal detectors and resource officers being used in the suburban schools? And if you want to strike a blow, not a blow, but a balance for gun rights and safety, that'd be a good place to start.
All right, thanks for the call.
I love that we have metal detectors at our school.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that.
Doors are locked. You cannot get in. They don't even care if you work there. There's a certain door you go in, certain door you go out.
So, I mean, and this is something for people to consider. I mean, I hear what Verlon is saying, and yeah, okay, school resource officer, harden the target with metal detectors. But, you know, how much of a prison do you want your kid's school to look like? How much of a prison do you want to be the environment in which your child is supposed to learn? Not that there's much learning going on in most of these schools anyway, so I don't know. Maybe it's past post. Mary,
when I lived in Detroit, we'd go through a metal detector to go to a movie theater, and that was in the 90s.
Yeah, well.
So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it could be coming
to. Yeah, going to prison is like going to school, because I've been to jails, and you go through the same thing. You put your keys here, you go through. It's same if you go to a courthouse downtown.
Well, I know, but is that how you want to live is the question.
Adds a huge layer of security, so I'm keeping kids safe. I'm all about.
Hello?
Mary Midway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, God, I feel like I got a double whammy. It's enough that I want to vomit from these horrific events, but then I have to listen to the big guy. I want to vomit again. But I was going to say, like the other two, I know this is not that simple, and this is hindsight, but, geez, I just wish... Not necessarily this example of what happened, but if it was previous innocent people who have died, and there will be future, because there's no force in the they took the force out of police force. If the police could really do their job, I mean, I know they might not have caught this guy as they were tracking him yesterday, and they didn't know, but, I mean, they got to, you know, put more force in the police force.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Frank, Northwest Side.
Yes. Hi, Dan and Amy. Hope you're doing well. I just wanted to bring up a point. Yes, we definitely, in my opinion, I think we should definitely have metal detectors in the high schools. But I also think that the, you know, these video games that have come out lately, you know, with the extreme violence, I mean, I don't know if that's playing a role, but I think it has something to do with, you know, a lot of these kids with, like, these gun fetishes. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's just my opinion. But what do you think?
Thanks for the call, Frank. I mean, look, the video games, I mean, there's, you know, again, it's just tough to make any causal link. I don't think there is any compelling evidence of a causal link. And we go back to say that you have tens of millions of hormonal male teenagers playing video games, and the violence is limited to the video games.
Well, the Buffalo shooter, he was streaming live that shooting on one of his video platforms, his video game platforms. And it looked like, when you see it, it looks and it sounds like, you know, Call of Duty, or what was that, Fortnite they used to play? Or I don't
yes.
There's so many different ones, but.
So that establishes a causal link between his video game playing and his shooting up a supermarket?
Well, he liked it enough that he decided to share with his followers that he's going to go light up and kill black people at a supermarket. And he killed three white people, too.
So the shooter in Texas yesterday posted on Instagram or whatever. So Instagram made him do it?
No, he just wanted to get attention. Both of
right. These. So you know, I think we're on the periphery when we're talking about social media or Facebook Live or video games. There's just not any evidentiary support for a causal link between those things. John and Huntley.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. I want to talk a little bit about what Rusty Reno talked about in First Things last month about the culture of death. And he talked about it from an LGBTQ, or whatever those numbers are. But he talks about it in the sense that this is just another thing that's going on from the culture of death in the womb. And you watch, it's going to wind up going not just through transgenderism, it's going to go through euthanasia someday. All you can do is pray. That's all we can do.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Matt, Fox River Grove.
Thanks for taking my call. My dad's 91 years old. He tells stories when he was a kid. He would go to school. He'd get a new rifle, and he'd bring it to school for show and tell. Other kids would do the same thing. There weren't any shootings there. So what's the difference? The difference was, back then, there was a focus on faith, where God was allowed in people's lives, in schools and everywhere. There was a focus on family. Fathers were an integral part of people's lives. They weren't discarded as meaningless. Marriage, the sanctity of marriage was a prevalent thing in families. And all of that is gone. It's not the instrument. It's what's going on in our society that's the problem.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Yeah, I mean, think about people who are listening who are faithful or attempt to be. Why? And what has your faith done for you? Does it keep you on the right side of the abyss? Does it keep you from indulging some of your worst instincts because you're reminded of what's right and wrong, because you're supposed to live your life to glorify God? Does that keep some of your sinful impulses in check? Not completely and not always for everybody, but think about that as a restraint on bad behavior, as living for something bigger than yourself, which is what so many of these young people are looking for. They want to be important, and they want to think they're part of doing something important. I mean, those that are otherwise know the difference between right and wrong, who commit these horrific wrongs. Kathy, Southwest Side.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. I do actually agree with the last caller, too. You know, I think the evolution of our society is just, it's inevitable. These kids are exposed to more technology, bad, obviously, with social media. But also, I do think mental illness does play a huge role. I think it takes on many forms, whether somebody, because of our evolution of society, somebody feels rejected or they feel wronged or they were isolated and now they're being shamed on the internet. You know, who knows? But, you know, and I do think the family component to make the person stronger also helps. I don't think it's one thing. I think it's very complex. And the violence that these kids are exposed to, you take a country like Sweden, there's certain things that are against the law of violence. They can have nudity in that country, but they reject certain levels of violence. And I think it all contributes. It's so unfortunate, but that's where we're headed.
Thanks, Kathy. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.